Last week, I explored the theme of going into the darkness and using this time of year and the darkness that's there externally as a reference point for our practice, and used the example of being with the darkness to offer us some inspiration for how to approach practice during this time. I invited people in the last week to use some of the understandings of being with the darkness to help guide practice, to help give some, again, some reference points and some inspiration for one's practice. So last week, I gave some metaphors for what it means to practice with the darkness. I talked about being with the dark as stopping, being like the earth. Talked about being with the dark as being with what's difficult or painful. At times, being with the dark, thirdly, as not knowing. And then fourthly, talked about being with the dark as generative and fertile. And again, the invitation was to see how we might use these metaphors to guide and hopefully inspire practice during this time. And so how many of you worked some with those metaphors in the last week? That's good. So what we'll do in the discussion time is have a chance to share some of what we might have explored. So what I thought I'd do would be to review briefly some of the territory we covered and then bring in some further ways that we can understand what it means to practice with darkness. Practice with, today, darkness and wetness. And we can sense from the number of people here that some people prefer to practice with darkness without going out into the dark. So I want to bring in further a sense of being with the dark as being with what we might call our shadow areas. And then also talk about being with the dark as inviting the luminous, inviting light into our being. And in many ways, the sense of darkness as stopping is really, as it were, being like the earth. You know, I looked up today some of what actually goes on with plants in the dark. Have you ever studied that? So I thought, here's what goes on with plants in the dark. They basically, you know, they basically take care of things and get ready for the new season of spring. So this is what I found. Photosynthesis slows. Respiration slows. Growth stops. Plants use the dormancy of winter to keep their houses in order. The dormancy is much more than a period of suspending animation. It's part survival mechanism, part housekeeping exercise, all meant to help plants gear up for warmer days ahead. Only when a seed has been exposed to low temperatures for long enough, a process known as cold stratification, that plant hormones trigger the end of dormancy. At that time, the seed can then germinate, a process governed by the plant hormones. So there's a lot going on, and it's connected with the cycles for the plant. And in so many cultures in the Northern Hemisphere, this was a time of stopping. And really, in some ways, offering a time away to really take stock of where people were, what's happening with the earth. And so we have, in so many cultures, the stopping and the coming together for ceremonies. In Native American cultures around here, in ancient Northern European cultures. I think I mentioned last time that Stonehenge was constructed to be able to tell the exact time of the winter solstice. Right? And that we have other stone formations very, very similar. We have these ceremonies of appreciating the light. And again, I think that there's this remarkable fact that Jesus was not born on December 25th. Right, but they, in fact, scholars aren't exactly sure when he was born. But, some people think because of some of the evidence in the Bible that it was the spring. You talk about the shepherds with their flocks and all that, which didn't exactly happen at on December 25th, right? Oh, and some think it was in the fall, but it definitely wasn't the winter. But they shifted it so that they'd have a good holiday that could compete with the pagan holidays. That's why they did it. That's pretty clear. And then Hanukkah was also ramped up to compete with the Christmas. A minor Jewish holiday became, something big or bigger, right? So, but in any case, the invitation here was to see if there's a time in these weeks, in the next few weeks, when we could stop and maybe meditate more, have some more quiet time. Whatever it's there for you, that's what it would mean to follow the metaphor of stopping, taking the darkness as stopping. Can I really have time that I'm not so busy? That I look within, have a sense really of being ready for renewal, right? And I think, one can ask, there's all the crises in the world. Why should we stop? Don't we have to just keep on going and take care of things? And I've certainly been more aware in the last week with the climate talks. Anyone followed the climate talks some? Right, that, if you really take things seriously, you could say, I need to just respond to the urgency all the time. But there's something about the power of, if one is motivated. And I was thinking there's a poem that's pretty powerful. Some people know who Drew Dellinger is? He's a poet. I think he lives in Marin. No, maybe San Francisco. But he's in the Bay Area. And this is the beginning of a poem called Hieroglyphic Stairway. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake. Because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep, my great-great-grandchildren asked me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing, as the mammals, reptiles, birds were all dying. Did you fill the streets with protests when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew? It's powerful. And it goes on like that. And I know that maybe how many of us have been aware and wondered, what can I do? How many of you think of that, right? What can I do? I know it's, for me, it's like I'm trying to have a sense of how to use my energies at this time, and it's hard, but one could say, why should we meditate? Shouldn't we just be active all the time? But there's something about, I think, the need for renewal this is probably going to be something that we need our energies for a while. And so having periods of pulling back and then going back to activity is really crucial. Being there for the long haul, what really is helpful for the long haul? And I think of friends I know. I have one friend who is an abbot of a monastery in Thailand. And he's been following a pattern a lot of doing 6 months practice with his monastery and 6 months of ecological activism. Pretty interesting. That was very inspiring to me to hear that, you know, this balance of the two. So this first metaphor is about stopping, and I think we can see it as having the need for renewal and inspiration, being with what's there. And then there's a second theme that I mentioned last time of being with the darkness as being with the difficult, which is really crucial, you know, that we often think of being with the dark as being with pain or being with what's difficult or being with what's challenging. And I think you can see from the different metaphors used that I'm trying to see the both the powerful, difficult aspects of darkness, but also the positive aspects. So really seeing how darkness can be generative and luminous. It's not simply something negative, but it's quite important. And so the second theme that we looked at is thinking of taking this time, can I be with what's difficult in my life? Where I used also the suggestion of being with what's unresolved. Can I be with what's unresolved in my life? Can I take this time to have that emphasis? You know, and we know that one of the really powerful aspects of our practice is that it gives us skillful ways to be with what's painful or difficult. It's really, I think, it of one of the great treasures of the tradition, that we can, when something difficult occurs, we have some tools. We don't just go into habitual mode. It's almost like something difficult or painful happens, and hopefully for us, a light bulb goes on. Maybe we notice some habitual tendencies, and then we say, time for practice, right? At least put something on your refrigerator, right? So, and last time we remembered the core teaching of the two arrows, you know, which is the most, I think, the most concise expression of the whole of the path. A practice, which is basically about what to do when things are difficult or unpleasant. And noticing that we have a tendency when things are difficult or unpleasant or painful, and that's called the first arrow, we have a tendency to shoot a second arrow, if that would help. That's reactivity. And the center of our practice is transforming reactivity. So it means that when we have something difficult, we both watch the tendencies to react, which would be predictable, right? And then we try not to react. You know, and we have a number of ways that we work with what's difficult or painful, ranging from being mindful, being present, being with sadness or grief, being with anger, being with whatever the emotions are, and saying, let me be mindful of that. Let me investigate. Let me study what's there. Again, the usual tendency would be to shoot the second arrow. We have something difficult happen and we just, you know, judge ourselves, blame ourselves, say, woe is me, whatever it is. You know, and so we need to look at those forms of reactivity and work with them. And there's a special place for loving kindness and the heart practices, compassion, when we have something, when we have difficulty or pain. So that was a second metaphor that was pointed to. Can we, in this time, when there's some difficulty, can we be with it without shooting the second arrow? There was Something that was powerful for me from watching some of the climate talks, and it reminded me that there's a way in which being with the difficult and being with the unknowing can have aspects of what in Christian mysticism is called the dark night of the soul. Something I've talked about. I did a day-long last year on the dark night of the soul. You know, and I had done, I think the year before, I had done a workshop. I had been a participant in a workshop with a woman named Mirabai Starr on the theme of the dark night. And it's very relevant here that, you know, how many of you know of the dark night? It's powerful, and I think it's very relevant sometimes individually, but it's like collectively we're going through a dark night, which is marked by pain, confusion, and not knowing often. It's right at the heart of the dark night. So, this was St. John of the Cross from the 16th century talking about the dark night as actually a more advanced stage of spiritual practice. Beginners don't go into the dark night, so it's not the same thing as just having a hard time or being depressed a little bit, right? It's actually something really painful and confusing, and it can be catalyzed by loss, by painful experiences, by confusion, right? Mirabai Starr talked about how she was catapulted into a several-year dark night by the loss of her 14-year-old daughter in an automobile accident. This was someone who had done years and years of spiritual practice, but suddenly nothing had any meaning, right? And she was in the darkness. And the theme will be, or the pointer from that will be, that it's something one sometimes has to just be with and stay with, and there can be something fruitful and generative that comes out of it. So this is what she said: with reticence at first and then courage, I dared to grieve my child. I practiced turning toward a feeling that I did not think I could survive. Abiding with what is, I sat with that. I did this as an act of devotion for my daughter, saying yes to the mystery, expressing my ongoing love. Showing up for a devastating loss was an act of love. I wasn't trying to be spiritual. I knew it was all about love. It was all I could do. But there was also this sense of dryness, of things that were previously meaningful practices and understandings, even books, no longer meaningful. Something very, you know, a dark night. And I was thinking about this also in terms of the collective dark night. Did anyone here see the interview of Amy Goodman with a 15-year-old Swedish girl named Greta Thunberg? Anyone see that? It was quite something. You know, she's 15, and she went through a kind of a dark night. She said that, and she traveled with her, I think her father, in an electric car from Sweden to Poland for the climate talks. But she said she started reading about the climate crisis in school when she was 9 years old. She's 15 now. And her teachers told her about it. And she said, I became very depressed. I fell into depression. And I mean, I didn't think it was. I was so depressed, I didn't see any point of living, because everything was just so wrong. And so she actually stopped eating. She stopped talking for a period of time. And she left school and stayed at home for almost a year. And she was in a kind of, you could call that a kind of a dark night precipitated by the climate crisis, right? I'm going to come back to her because she had support from her parents, and something came out of that dark night. So I'll come back to this. So I'll leave us in suspense. What happens to Mirabai Star? What happens to Greta? What happens to St. John of the Cross? They're in the dark night. And it really is related to the third theme of not knowing, because the dark night is really that of not knowing. And they have to hang out with not knowing. And so, again, in terms of what's unresolved in our lives or unresolved in the world, can we be with what we don't know? Can we be with what sometimes is mysterious? You know, there's a card here that I brought here from Oren. Is having, as you know, he had a day long at Spirit Rock today, and he has his new book has come out on wise speech, skillful speech. And one of his cards says, "Learning begins with a willingness to not know," which is difficult in our culture, right? And so we can take, again, this time of darkness and say, let me be willing not to know for a period of time. We take this as inspiration when something is unresolved. Can I just say, don't know? How many of us do that? What's the usual tendency when we don't know?
Make it up.
Huh?
Make it up.
Make it up.
Google it.
But I'm talking about knowing something deeper, actually, not so much knowledge. This is when we don't know how to proceed in some part of our life. You know, I don't know what to do. Or I'm retired and I'm confused. Or, you know, I'm no longer able to work where I was working. You know, and this is one of the things which we can do with retreats, is to listen really, really deeply for what's there. You can do it in meditation. Meditation can be a kind of deep listening beneath the knowing. And one of the great, again, great values that we can sit. And I know that for me, it's been really crucial to be on retreat sometimes when I didn't know what was next. I've done that twice in my life. I've had what we might call sabbaticals. One was about 30 years ago. The other one was about almost 20 years ago, 18, 19 years ago. And both times I wasn't sure what came next, and I had almost 15 months without the usual busyness. And I did a lot of retreats in that time, and it really was necessary to do that, to really touch something deeper, to touch some deeper impulse. I think that's also the answer for me as to how to respond to the larger crisis. I think we need to have enough quiet so we touch something deeper in ourselves. And this can be something where we just listen, where we don't really know what's happening, where we don't know what the next step is, but we trust in the listening. So there's a lot of faith, trust, need for confidence, right? The confidence that if I listen deeply enough, I'll know what to do. You know, and when I've talked with particularly spiritually grounded activists who read their stories, there were always stories of them not knowing what to do, but having a kind of trust that they would be able to touch something deeper. You know, very powerful story with Dr. King of one day being really triggered, we might say, by being home at midnight with his family asleep and getting harassing telephone calls. There weren't answering machines in those days. And he got calls calling him the N-word and saying, if you don't get out of town, we'll blow up your house. And he had to stay with that at midnight. And all of his usual confidence disappeared. And he had a cup of coffee. May not have been the best thing at midnight. That's what he did. And he stayed around that, and he went through a kind of crisis of faith. And he said that he didn't know what to do. There was no one who could really call. It was too late. He couldn't call his parents and talk to them. And he didn't know what to do, and he just stayed there. And something welled up from the depths, and he thought that he actually heard the voice of Jesus telling him, "You are doing good work, Martin Luther. Stay there, and I will be with you." And he said something shifted. He heard something deeper, and it gave him quite a confidence. In actuality, his house was bombed 4 days later. And people were amazed at the level of equanimity that he manifested, talking at press conferences and so forth. And he later attributed it to that sitting around the table with a cup of coffee. There was something about going into his depths. He, you know, for him, it didn't take a retreat. It happened pretty quickly, but he had prepared for that. Right? So there is that way of being willing to be with the unknown, with the mysterious, and be with the trials and tribulations. And the not knowing is also part of the dark night of the soul. St. John of the Cross has this amazing line I found really amazing. He says, "The soul walks to God through human unknowing." And we could imagine the Buddhist counterpart of that. But it's really about, you know, he's more or less saying all the books, all the teachings, all the doctrines, maybe they prepare you. But the depth, the in-depth understanding comes out of not knowing. He also says it comes, for him, it actually comes out of that crisis of not knowing when everything dries up. Right? So this can give some faith for the difficult times, and we have some reference points. He says, this is a poem from St. John, "I entered into unknowing and remained there, knowing nothing. I had no idea where I was. I suddenly understood, I started to understand sublime things, ineffable things. I would not even try to say what I felt as I let myself down into the arms of unknowing. The embrace of unknowing transcends all thought." So we can see from that the difficulty, the pain, the unknowing can be generative. So again, this is to, you know, hopefully the talk gives seeds that at a certain moment when there are things that are difficult or confusing or things dry up, you suddenly remember, oh yes, December 16th, 2018, the talk at the St. Luke's Presbyterian Church. Oh yes. I can reorient everything now. You know, forget those negative shootings of the second arrow. So that's my hope. So the fourth point, which I didn't bring up last time, I want to talk a little bit about darkness as shadow. Shadow is a pretty interesting word, right? So shadow in psychology, particularly inspired by the psychology of Carl Jung, is about those parts of ourselves which we don't like or don't want to admit or feel shame about or are confused about, that somehow get repressed from consciousness. Jung said that the shadow of the individual is the negative side of the personality, the sum of all those unpleasant qualities we like to hide. So what might be in the shadow? Maybe if I think of myself as a calm person, maybe my anger's in the shadow. Or areas that I might feel shame about are in the shadow. You know, things that we don't feel good about ourselves, whatever that might be. You know, and there are a lot of possibilities. You know, could be our work, our achievements, you know. Something that happened, some wound, goes into the shadow. And I think there's also a way, this wasn't so much emphasized in the psychology of Jung, but I think there's also very much a way that our beautiful qualities can be part of the shadow. That we don't think so well of ourselves and our shining, our deep connection with our spirits may also be part of the shadow. And one of the ways we can tell that there's shadow material is that we can be very reactive about certain things at times, and also we do what in psychology is called projection. You know projection? So if anger is part of my shadow, I'm going to criticize people who are angry, right? Or one of the reasons I think that there's so much beautiful shadow, or so many beautiful parts of ourselves in shadow, is that we project so much onto people we call stars. Isn't that interesting? We call them stars, and we project our light onto them, and we, and I don't know if that's true of us, but so many people in the world, they orient towards the stars, whether movie stars or sports stars, and everything is about them, and where's my brilliance and my shining? Maybe we're not in touch with it. So that can be part of the shadow too. And we can see where we project, right? And the shadow is also something that's very much collective. We have collective shadow. Need I say more? We have material in our culture that we don't want to look at. Typically what's painful, right? And so we have massive shadows in the culture related to what's happened with the Native Americans and with people of African descent. The near Native genocide, slavery, Jim Crow, all sorts of things are in the shadow. Sometimes we deal with them a little bit, but they're still in the shadow, right? I was thinking of how in South Africa they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which had severe limitations, but it still was the most advanced way of coming to grips with the collective shadow that's ever occurred, in my estimation, in human history, right? We could use that. We could use a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or two, or three, right? And so we don't want to look at certain things. We don't want to look at the fact that our foreign policy has probably killed 20 million people in the last 70 years. That's true. There wasn't much about the collective shadow and foreign policy after George H.W. Bush died, right? Could have been. We don't deal with shadow. We try to make everything nice, right? And we project evil onto others, and we don't see our own. That's collective shadow. That's what happens, right? Thomas Merton said that we suppress our own negativity and we project evil onto others. Right? So that's the shadow. So how do we work with shadow? How do we work with our shadow? Do it in a lot of different ways. Meditation is a beautiful way to work with shadow. I think that, especially doing retreats, how many people have a sense that in meditation you get in touch with some of your suppressed parts of yourself? Very much, right? I found in retreats really just a sense of really getting to know what I wasn't really conscious of. For me it was a lot of stuff, especially initially around anger, around fear, around self-image, stuff really, and especially with retreats, stuff just comes up. The basic idea is you don't have any new input when you meditate, so stuff bubbles up. That's the basic idea. That's why it's good, that's why there's some value in not doing too many guided meditations and just having some time where you don't fill up the space, and then you can work with stuff. And of course, many other ways to contact the shadow. From the psychological traditions, we have working with dreams as very fundamental. We could have different kinds of ritual. A lot of cultures have had rituals as a way to deal with the shadow, right? And can have ways that one comes to grips with the grief or the collective grief of a society after something negative has happened. Ceremony, one could do psychological work is a very key way. You know, as some of you know, for me, one of the ways of doing shadow work was when I was enrolled in the Clown School of San Francisco. This was, I think you know, something that I did just as I was, I wanted to do it before I started doing a lot of teaching at Spirit Rock. So I became a clown. Sometimes still am, maybe. You know, my clown name is Garbanzo Bean. And I have a clown subpersonality called Guru Garbanzo Bean, who sometimes comes out when I answer questions badly. But I found that doing the clown work was really a way of getting in touch with shadow. You know, it was really great. In fact, what we were asked to do was to find our shadow, and then develop clown skits based on the shadow, in which we found our shadow or something negative we thought about ourselves, and we would publicize it in our skits and exaggerate it. Sometime I'll have to bring in, I have films of my clown skits. Anyway, you know, one of the ways we did that, I probably have talked about this some, but we would, part of our training was to develop a clown walk where we would walk in front of about 20 people and they would make comments about how the weird aspects of our walking. And then we would, you know, bring that into our clown walk, you know, and exaggerate it. So people would say, you know, I really like how part of your butt kind of moves around in one way and another part in another way. And it's really pretty cute, you know, and that would become our clown walk, you know, learn how to do that. And so, anyway, that's a way to be in touch with the shadow. But really crucial part, can we really, you know, and, you know, most nightmares of dreams would be really actually in some way referring to the shadow. So again, this can be something that we attend to. Can I be with the shadow territory? Can I work with that? And all of, you know, I think you can see that all of these ways of being with the dark, stopping, being with the difficult, painful, not knowing, being with the shadow, can be tremendously fruitful and generative. And this is really why I'm bringing this up, that we, that being with the darkness in these ways brings us to ways of knowing and insights that we wouldn't have otherwise. Can be very, 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 very fertile, very, very powerful, you know, as in the example with Dr. King. You know, it was very powerful to hear that the kind of dark night that Greta Thunberg went through, the Swedish girl of 15, she, after a year or two of being in this awful, difficult depression, kind of like a dark night, and something came out of it, and she started, she decided that she needed to go on strike. She went back to school, but then after a while she decided to go on strike from school. And once a week, she would go on strike from school and have a sign about strike because of climate change or climate disruption. And then she also picketed. She sat in front of the Swedish parliament and she had a sign that Sweden had to do something, the world had to do something. And she became well enough known from that she was invited to speak at the climate summit to all the delegates. And so she got up and her speech is on the web, you can see it. I just wanted to read the end of her speech. This came out of being with depression, with the not knowing. This is a fruit. Listen to this. The year 2078. I will celebrate my 75th birthday. If I have children, maybe they will spend the day with me. Maybe they will ask me about you. Maybe they will ask why you didn't do anything. This is to the delegates. Why you didn't do anything while there was still time to act. You say you love your children above all else, and yet you were stealing their future in front of their very eyes. Until you start focusing on what needs to be done rather than what is politically possible, there is no hope. We cannot solve a crisis without treating it as a crisis. We need to keep the fossil fuels in the ground, and we need to focus on equity. And if solutions within the system are so impossible to find, then maybe we should change the system itself. We have not come here to beg world leaders to care. You have ignored us in the past, and you will ignore us again. We have run out of excuses, and we are running out of time. We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not. The real power belongs to the people. Thank you. The end of her speech. And so the darkness can be generative. I'll just end with a few passages, then we can share some of what we may have explored. Rilke was a poet who wrote a lot about the dark. This is a line from Rilke. One moment your life is like a stone in you, and the next it's like a star. One moment a stone, the next moment a star. Rumi, some nights stay up till dawn, as the moon sometimes does for the sun. Be a full bucket pulled up the dark way of a well, then lift it out into the light. Rilke, I love the dark hours of my being. My mind deepens into them. There I can find, as in old letters, the days of my life already lived and held like a legend and understood. Then the knowing comes. I can open to another life that's wide and timeless. From the Sufi poet Hafez. I wish I could show you when you are lonely or in the darkness, the astonishing light of your own being. So again, the invitation is to see if any of these metaphors resonate with you and inspire you for the next period of time, particularly encouraging some period of stopping. And then have your radar up for moments when you might be going into some habitual ways of reacting to what's difficult, painful, to not knowing. Your shadow material may be surfacing, and see if you can have this other approach. This is all about another approach to the difficult, the painful, the unknown, the unconscious. That really is so crucial for our practice. So you sit for a moment and see if this resonated with you. What might you like to do in the next week or two? So thank you, and we have a little bit of time for talking together, and particularly anyone who may have explored this in the last week, you'd be very welcome to speak, or anyone with a question or a story or something to invite maybe more from me. We'll use the mic.
I didn't specifically practice anything in relation to your talk.
Yeah.
partially, I think, that I'm really dealing with it. And so continuing practice, I think, is to just watch, because I think at this point for me, and probably for many of us, it's really more than I can do to really profoundly change that immediately, but at least a starting place is to not let myself off the hook about what I am limitedly doing in those places along the lines of what I just said.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, the continuation of the practice of consciousness, of being aware. And you're probably familiar with Wendell Berry's poem about dark. I don't know how many other people do. If you want to, you can pull it up. But basically, it's a very short poem. And what he says is, if you want to go dark, go dark.
Mm-hmm.
Go without light. Because if you take a light in there, it's no longer dark. So it really is like pushing ourselves to go to that extra level or the next extra level, because whatever we think we think or we think we can do isn't it yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's still just light in the dark.
Yeah, thank you for really just acknowledging. It's hard sometimes to acknowledge our bad habits. Anyone not have bad habits? Okay. Right, but I think, you know, it's like really, I think for me, some of the energy, particularly of that 15-year-old girl, Greta Thunberg, it really is about being honest, right? And acknowledging, oh yes, for different reasons, and it's not just personal responsibility. It's like our leaders aren't—they're not. You know, I mean, there are organizations one could work with on a number of different issues, and many of you do that. But just to acknowledge, here are my habits. Here is what I'm doing. I don't feel comfortable with my level. I'm implying that, but I don't know what to do, and I have habits, right? And so, just to acknowledge that. And to sometime, you know, for some time, be in a period of not knowing and see what comes again from somewhere deeper, you know, to go dark, as it were. That's what I'm taking from what you said, which I think is quite helpful. Thank you. I remember, just to say, I remember, you know, studying, they had some studies of nonviolent movements in multiple countries. I forget the name of the author, but she did a lot of study of what it takes for a nonviolent movement to be successful. What they found is that when there was 2.5% participation or greater, when they looked at like 20 or 30 countries, when there was that level of participation, nonviolent action was always successful, 100%. It's interesting. So, yeah, please.
I've been sort of stuck in this dark.
A little closer.
Stuck in this dark night for a few years of my own personal physical pain and illness and fear of what the future is going to be like with aging, no money, and my partner being very, very ill and probably dying before me, and I've been dependent on his money. So I have had this just sat in this fear, and what's come out is I'm facing it. I'm working with or talking to Roy, who is the director of the Zen Hospice Center, about old age and dying and illness. Mm-hmm. And I also being friends with a 97-year-old woman who is perfectly mentally all there, but she's blind, and she was a psychologist. And I'm visiting with her a lot, and just facing what my worst, you know, like going into it and experiencing it, seeing what it's like.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're going into it there, you're going into it here for our benefit, really, being willing to do that. Thank you. Yeah, but it sounds like there was a period where it was just disorienting. And that this, you know, sort of, at a certain point, you were willing to go into it, act more.
It was a period of a lot of Ativan.
Yeah. Yeah, just be feel disoriented, depressed some, and so forth, and it's it really points to the fact something I didn't mention in the talk, that if we become skilled at being with what's difficult, painful, unknown, we can be guides for others, as you are. That's a very significant that. The world deeply needs those who have looked at their own shadow, looked at their own difficulties and been with not knowing, been with confusion, open to something like the dark night, and stayed with it and come out the other end. Then you can be a guide. In this instance, you can be a guide because you know that and you know what comes up. You can be a guide for others who are older, maybe when they're dying, you know, people who are skillful with all of this are very much needed for being with the collective shadow material, the collective dark night, right? The society needs those who are active and, what should I say, not scared easily, right? That's what's needed, right? So we can all be in training to be really effective by hanging out with our own unknown difficulties and so forth. Your story shows completely how you can then be helpful for others, right? So thank you. Really, really important point, yeah. Both interpersonally and I think collectively, the point is a good one. Tom, please.
I really appreciate your emphasis on being with not knowing and then calling it mystery, which is it's so important. As somebody who's needed so desperately to know so much about everything, answers, and to suspend that desire and just be with not knowing is very free.
Really, really crucial, and we can do that in so many ways, right? We can do that with a situation, you know, again, situation in one's life, change, confusion. We can also do it with every time we meditate. We can say, let me be with not knowing what will happen. Yeah? Let me be with the mystery of this next moment. So we can practice all of this in meditation. And, you know, I know for me it's been really important, particularly again on retreats. And for any of us, when we get into habits with meditation, I think we talked about this last time, that we sometimes, many of us sometimes have habits that we kind of go into what we think will be a nice, peaceful, calm groove. And there's not much appreciation of mystery. It's kind of like, okay, if I do this, I sit this, kind of do this, it'll be kind of peaceful. But I may not be noticing so much. And so can I be with the mystery? I don't know what's going to happen this next moment or this next moment. Can I really stabilize my attention and then be with mystery? I know for me, I've done that quite a number of times at times, when, particularly on retreat, when I would find myself wanting something to happen or getting irritated because something wasn't happening. And just, or maybe a little bit distracted, and then just to say, let me just be with the mystery, moment to moment. So it's a very nice way to guide one's own practice, as well as guide other aspects of life. So thank you.